Hi, everybody. My name is S.C. Hamilton. I am originally from London, if you can't tell. But 2.5 years ago, my husband and I, with my kids, my family, we moved to Florida. So I do not fly here from London. I flew here from Florida. And it is freezing here. I lived in London most of my life, but I'm used to the freezing cold. But for some reason,
I forgot about it.
And I realized I didn't have really a good coat. So I ran to Zara in Florida and bought myself a coat. It's not warm. And I realized I didn't bring Uggs, so my toes are just numb. But it's okay. The mosquitoes and fish is worth it. So this is the third day of my pre-Hanukkah speaking tour across the Tri-State area. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much, Miriam, for hosting. Thank you for offering to host the show in your home. I love actually giving shiurim in homes. I feel like it brings so much into the home, and it just feels like the right place to be. So we're going to inspire ourselves about Hanukkah, because I feel like women, we get very busy with all the doing of the Hanukkah, of every Yom Kippur, right? So before Sukkot, we're like decorating the Sukkot, making the tablescape, and then before Pesach, we're cleaning, and we're making all the... Before Hanukkah, we're like looking up, at least I am looking up, donut recipes every year, another donut recipe, and the latke recipes, and like which family is coming for what night, and what the presents are going to be, and do we have chocolate coins? I'm so busy with all the stuff that actually creates such a warm, loving atmosphere in the home and bring the Yom Kippur into your home. So we're busy with doing very important things, but we forget sometimes to engage with the spiritual content of the Yom Kippur because we're so busy with the physical content of the Yom Kippur, because that is really, that's the way we bring the atmosphere into our home. So it's so lovely that all of you have come out a few days before Hanukkah. Hanukkah is on Sunday night, so a few days before Hanukkah to really speak about Hanukkah. And we know that this whole Yom Kippur is about L'chodesh L'Halal, right? This is the best Yom Kippur for the Thank You Hashem, organization, if you want to call it. Before Thank You Hashem, the TYA, we had to have been in fact thanking Hashem for like thousands of years, that. Just now we have all the merch. You have the stick of your car, and you have the t-shirts, you have the sweatshirts, you have the key rings, you have everything. But before we had all of that, we were a nation that we were Yehudim, right? Thanking Hashem all the time. So we already have that. And I was just thinking, it's just something very interesting, that we make a lot of brachas over Hanukkah, right? We make a bracha over our menorahs, and then everybody in the house makes the brachas over the menorahs, and we make brachas generally all the time, brachas over food, and then after brachas, and we give our children brachas, and we make brachas over every Yom Kippur, brachas over the shofar, brachas over the thing in the sukkah, brachas, and we meet somebody, brachas over the thunder and lightning, brachas over rainbow, you name it, there is a bracha for it. But there is one bracha that we say over nothing. There is one bracha that we say over nothing, and that bracha is when we bench Gomla. When something could happen to us, and would have happened to us, and might have happened to us, and didn't happen to us, we bench Gomla. What are we actually saying when we bench Gomla? We're saying, thank you Hashem for my status quo. Thank you Hashem that nothing bad happened, that nothing happened. But I keep the same. So after a woman gives birth, she has to say birth of in front of a million of men. But after any type of dangerous situation, you could have been in maybe a very dangerous surgery or whatever it is, you turn around and you bench them. And when you bench them, you're really saying, thank you, Hashem, for nothing. That nothing changed, right? Thank you, Hashem, for the dirty laundry that's in my laundry basket, and the dishes in my sink, and the noise that's in my house, and the mess, and the car that doesn't turn on when I try and turn it on. Thank you, Hashem, for all the things that are aggravating me. Thank you, Hashem, for my status quo, because that is really our biggest bracha. And we don't thank Hashem for it until we almost lose it, until we almost don't have it anymore, and suddenly nothing happens, and then we turn around, we bench around, we say thank you, Hashem, for nothing. But really for everything, right? So I always say that at the beginning of Hanukkah, when we the whole Yom Kippur is about thank you Hashem, and we say halal every single day for 8 days, and we say thank you Hashem all the time. But really what's so interesting about Hanukkah is that Hanukkah has two massive miracles. One miracle that we really, really needed, and one miracle that was totally unnecessary. And we actually celebrate the miracle that was totally unnecessary. Let me just talk you through the story. I know you know the story. But just in order to lay the foundation of what we're understanding about Hanukkah this time, right, I just want to talk you through the story. What's the story? So actually, Golas Yavon was a very, very interesting Golas, and I'll tell you why. all this other goddesses before Goddess Yavon was all about how can we kill Jews. We want to kill Jews and kill more Jews and kill them till they're dead, like we saw in the Holocaust, like we saw October 7th, like we speak about in Purim, the Hashmid, the Haroik, or the Abed. Let's just get rid of all the Jews, right? And we're used to it, we know it. And then there was Goddess Yavon. Goddess Yavon was a very interesting goddess because, first of all, the Jewish people actually lived in Eretz Yisrael at the time with the Greeks. They were actually in Eretz Yisrael. And Goddess Yavon was so interesting because the Greeks did not want to kill the Jewish people at all. In fact, what they wanted to do is they wanted to convert them, right? And lots of Jewish people were Misyavnim. Misyavnim comes from the word Yavon, which means they actually assimilated into the Greek culture. And I want to describe to you what the Greek culture was, because before Yavon came along, it was very barbaric. Society was very barbaric. So it was survival of the fittest. It was who could kill who first. It was very barbaric. And then the Greeks came along, and they were so sophisticated. They had poetry. They had philosophy. They had art. They had architecture. They had mathematics that people had never heard of or seen in their life. They had science. They had technology, of course, not like we have now. But they were the first kind of civilization who had technological advancements. And it felt so wise. It felt high. And it felt so wise. And it felt so... It almost smelled a little bit like terror, actually. It felt for the Jewish people, wow, this is so intelligent. This is so sophisticated. Like, we are creators, just like Hashem is creators. And so the Greeks turned around to the Jewish people and said, you know, we believe, like you believe, that God created the world. But then he left the world. God is not interested in humanity. God is much bigger than that. It's a bit like, I remember my grandfather, he was very into antiques. And he used to have this huge grandfather clock, which he started from the ground up to here. And he used to tick very, very loudly. It was an antique. And it was like the watchmaker who makes a watch and then leaves it to run on its own. And that was the Greek philosophy. The Greek philosophy was God did come and make this world. And then he left. He's not interested in us anymore. And he left. So now we are the gods. And therefore our body is, we should worship our body because we are gods. And therefore we should worship our own creativity and our own philosophy and our own ideas. And we should run the world and we kind of worship ourselves. And there is no God. And the Jewish people said, no, there is a God. And the Greeks said, listen, we like you very much. You're very intelligent. We don't really want to kill you. Just join us. Don't worry, there's no God. And quite a few Jews were misleading. They started to assimilate because it sounded so intelligent and it sounded like it made so much sense. And they kind of got taken in. And then there were the Hashemarim. The Hashemarim were Kohanim, right? And they turned around and they said, you don't understand what the Greeks are doing. They're taking away our neshama. In fact, in the Halal, which we'll be saying next week, we say, Lo hamesim yahaleluka. The dead will not praise Hashem. So that's a very interesting phrase, because obviously dead people can't praise Hashem. They can't praise anyone. They're dead. But the Mefarshim on that passage says that people who don't praise Hashem is considered like they're dead, even while they're alive. And the Hashmonaim turns around and said, if we let the Greek people take away our neshama, it's like we're walking dead. We have to wage war with the Greeks. And they got in a lot of trouble with other Jews. He said, are you crazy? The Greeks are so sophisticated. They have the most sophisticated warfare of their time. They have such a massive army. Are you crazy? Do you want to kill them? And so we see how sophisticated and intelligent they are. And maybe they're right. And what are you talking about? And the Hashmonaim said famously, Ni la shem elai. And you should just know, not very many people were with him. Very many people were very angry. Why are you trying to anger the Greeks? What are you doing? You're going to get us all killed. For what? For nothing. Right? And the Hashmonaim said, no, we have to fight. And it's not so interesting that the Kohanim never fought in any wars. Why? Because they weren't allowed near dead bodies. And this war was spearheaded by the Kohanim to show that this wasn't a physical war. This was actually a spiritual war. We are fighting for our spiritual life. And they actually entered into what is called a kamikaze war. A kamikaze war means a suicide mission. I think kamikaze is a Japanese word. And they use it to show the Japanese people, like, in order for the honor of the country, you should go and sacrifice yourself for the honor of the country. For the kamikaze war, a suicide mission. And the Hashmonaim all the truth told them, you are, it's a suicide, you are going to die. There is no way you're going to win, you're going to for sure die. And they said, rather we die with our neshama intact, than we live and we're like the walking dead. We're not interested. We're going to die fighting for our neshamas. And then they miraculously, unbelievably, won the war. And we don't really talk about it very much. I mean, we say in Allah, listen, we say, rather than Biyad Ma'asim, you know, we say, we mention it a little bit in benching or whatever, you know, in our Shema essay, but what do we really spend every single night doing? Every single night. We're obsessed with the oil. With the sack of oil. So let's talk about that miracle and what that miracle really meant, okay? So after the Hashemarim won this war, unbelievably won this war, they walk into the Beit HaMikdash that very same day, and as they walk into the Beit HaMikdash, they see that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed from the inside. So you know how this has happened to us, unfortunately. I remember when we lived in London, one morning we woke up, and we realized that we were robbed in the middle of the night. Somebody's come in the middle of the night, they've stolen our silver, they've stolen our laptops and our technology. We almost didn't notice at first. You know, when we don't, there's something missing, or we can't realize it, we have to call the police and file a police report. Of course, nothing happened from there, but it felt like so weird for somebody, you know. But it's like, imagine somebody goes away on vacation, and somebody comes to their house, instead of just like stealing their stuff, they graffiti the walls, and they take the chairs and they smash them, and they take all the crockery out of the cabinets, and they smash it on the floor, and they take a knife and they rip open your couches. So they're not only stealing your stuff, they're actually destroying your home. And that is what the Greeks did to the Beit HaMikdash. They filled it with pigs and with idols and with garbage, and they were trying to break the spirit of the Jewish people. So you know this house that you built for your God? God is not interested in you. We'll show you what we are going to fit it with, all the stuff that he says that we must have fit it with, and he can do nothing about it, and you can do nothing about it, and in this way we break your spirit, and this way you'll end up joining us Greeks, because you'll know that we're right, because we'll prove it to you. So the Hashemarim won this unbelievable war, and they walk into the Beit HaMikdash, and it is, they have to spend the whole day just cleaning everything out, take out the idols, and take out the pigs, and take out the garbage, and clean out, and then everyone talks about how finding this jug of oil was a miracle. But I want to tell you what I think the real miracle was. The real miracle was that they looked for the jug of oil. That they looked for HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the lowest moment. And this really is the indestructibility of the soul of the Jewish people. This moment, that's what it really is. Because what it means is that after they cleaned out the Beit HaMikdash, they wanted to light the menorah. Why? Because the menorah represented Torah. And they wanted to rekindle the Torah for the Jewish people of the time. And they said, we have to find oil. Now, it takes a week to make olive oil. So they could have waited a week. They said, no, we have to do it today, because we want to tell everybody this was not a physical war, this was a spiritual war. We must do it today. So what did they do? They went looking for oil. And you know what the Yevonim did with all the oil? So in those days, the jugs were made of clay. By the way, you know we learned that the jug of oil was very, very little. I want to tell you, the jug of oil was about a liter of oil. It was like a pitcher. You know the pitcher of water you put on the table? That's how big the jug of oil was. So some people think, oh, it must have been hiding by a rock. No. It was a huge pitcher of oil. They figured out exactly how much oil was needed, because in the menorah and the Beit HaMikdash had seven lights. They were all lit always, every single day, and each one was an entire cup. So if you just think of seven cups of oil, right, on this ginormous menorah that was in the gigantic menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, it must have been at least a liter of oil that they found. Oh, thank you very much. Ready for charcoal, thank you. Oh. So, they looked for the strand of oil, like looking for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Chaim Shmuel Levitt says, the strand of oil was a neshika from Hashem. A kiss from Hashem. What does the jug of oil really represent? It represented a moment in the Jewish people's life when they looked for Hashem and they found Hashem. They found this jug of oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. But then they had another question that they had to ask themselves. Should they light the menorah? It would last for 24 hours. And then it would be a whole week of no menorah and no oil lit. And then they'd be able to light the menorah again, or should they wait a week? Because they were trying to figure out, should they have a menorah that was continuously lit, or a menorah that was lit for 24 hours, not lit for a whole week, and then lit. Okay, so they were discussing it. And they decided they actually wanted to light the menorah immediately. because they wanted the talk of the town to be, could you hear the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash's lips? Could you hear? That's what they wanted. You know, there's the talk of the town. You know, who got engaged or who got married or something happened to somebody, or, right? They wanted to light the menorah immediately so that everybody would start talking. Did you hear? The menorah is it in the Beis HaMikdash. Did you hear? The Beis HaMikdash is up and running. Did you hear? That the Hashemite won the war against the Greeks and can now serve, we have the freedom to serve Hashem again. Did you hear? You can come inside. They're probably waiting. Come inside. Come inside. Sorry. Okay. That's what they wanted the talk of the town to be. Why was that important for them, for that to be the talk of the town? Because they wanted for everybody to be inspired. Wow, Hashem is really with us. Do you know why the menorah could be lit immediately? Because we found oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. We found something we would never think of finding. The talk of the town was the menorah is lit. And then they'd have to wait a week. Okay, and then they'd start lighting the menorah again and be continuous lighting, but this is what they wanted, right? And then Hashem did an ace, and it lit for long enough for them to make enough oil so that the menorah would be continuously lit. And this is really the magical story of Hanukkah. What is so interesting is, why don't we celebrate the war? Why don't we speak more about how we won the war? And not only that, we have seen in our own lives, we don't have to go back to the Hanukkah story, we've seen in our own lives. Do you remember, about a year ago, there was one Motzei Shabbos where about 250 nuclear warheads were heading for Eretz Yisrael. Do you remember that night? Okay. About a year into the war, suddenly there was big sirens in Eretz Yisrael. Everybody goes to their bunker. Nuclear, do you know what a nuclear warhead is? Just one of those bombs could have killed all 7 million Jews that lived in Eretz Yisrael. Half, which is, by the way, half the Jews in the world live in Eretz Yisrael. It would have killed half the Jews in the whole world, just one. 250 were headed to Eretz Yisrael from all different Arab nations. And then a miracle happened. And what was the miracle? Every single one, they managed to throw them in the skies, and the ones that they didn't manage to intercept fell into the sea or missed their mark. Not one person was killed. It was an open nation. It happened a year ago. And the next morning, everybody woke up, went to Makolet, ordered themselves some bread and milk, and carried on their day. I was like, Jewish people are crazy. Everybody should put on their Yom Tov clothes. We should make a Suda. We should say, today is a Yom Tov. Today, we were saved from annihilation. Jewish people are crazy. They woke up in the morning, oh yeah, yes, this was 250 new year words. We're totally fine. Yeah, let's go about our day. Everybody went to work. I was like, Jewish people are crazy. What's wrong with us? And even when I tell people, people remember, some people are vaguely remember. Oh yeah, I remember. Now that you remind, now you jog my memory. We were all saved from total annihilation like a year ago. And we didn't, that was our big deal. Why is it not a big deal? And I'll tell you why. Because Hashem promised Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov that there will always be Jewish people in the world. And in fact, we say, every single Seder night, we say, V'chol dar v'dar, amdim aleinu l'chalai seder. Every single generation. Why, by the way, lots of people are like, I'm so surprised by the I'm the least surprised person by the rise in anti-Semitism. Because it's written, it's possible. In the Torah, I know it's going to happen. It's not even, I can see it, it's written. Behold, over there, in every generation, people are going to rise up and try and tell the Jews, this is not a big shock, this is not a big surprise, we know. But we don't have to worry, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Eodom. Hashem will save us. Hashem promised he'll save us. He's always going to save us. So in fact, the miracle that the Hashemite managed to overcome the Greeks, who were the most powerful nation of the time, wasn't that, even though it was a miracle, it's kind of a miracle that Hashem had to do, because he had to keep his promise, right? Hashem doesn't promise that he will show his face to us. In fact, the Brit Rav calls the jug of oil He'oras Panim. He'oras Panim means Hashem shows his face. We say that we live in Golos. Golos means darkness. Darkness really means Hester Panim. I can't see it clearly. Have you ever said to somebody, I don't know what Hashem wants from me. I wish there was like a Nevuah, a Basel should come down and say, Esti, this is what Hashem wants you to do. I will do it. I would like to do what Hashem wants you to do. I don't know what it is. That is Golos. Right there, when we say we live in darkness and we lack clarity, that is Golos. Golos is, I can't see the MS from the Sheker. I can't see in this darkness what is the truth. I can't see what I should be doing. Even if I want to do the right thing, I cannot see it. Right? That is Golos. And then Hashem, what he does, is he does for us something magical and wonderful. He does something called Te'erah Panim, which means in our own life, in all of our own personal life, Hashem lifts the curtain. Yes? Here sometimes something happens and 5 years later you're like, oh, that's why I needed to meet that person. That's why I needed to go on that trip. That's what that needed to happen to me. That's why I had to, right? Oh, now it all makes sense. Like 5 years ago, it was all dark by Hashem. Lifted the curtain a little bit for me to see the truth of what I needed to see, because that's the real MS. Right? And often we feel very lost. We feel like we don't know what is MS and what is Sheker because we live in God. And then Hashem leaves us a jug of oil, a big, huge jug of oil, with a seal of the Kohen Gadol. And then they light the menorah, and it lasts for 8 days, and this is called He'orach Panim. This is Hashem saying that to the Hashanah, you did the right thing. You fought an honest battle. You fought a battle, Akedah Hashem. You did the right thing. And in fact, there are different times in our lives of He'orach Panim. For example, the most, one, like, I would say that when Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz calls it a neshika from Hashem, what it really means is Hashem is really, you're on a hard journey, this is the journey you have to go on, but you should know that I am here with you, right? It's not that I take away the hardship of your journey, but rather I'm here with you. And one of the most famous examples of this is Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef, right? That Yosef HaTzadik was thrown into a pit by his brothers, and they decided that wasn't bad enough, and they sold him into slavery. So Yosef was having a pretty bad day, I would say. Yeah? And then in the pasuk it says, and they sold him into slavery, and the people that they sold him to were carrying suit-setting prices. And I want to ask you, if you were just sold in slavery by your brothers, would you care if it's not like the Sonim or not? You're having a bad day. Okay? You're having a very, very bad day. Okay? Oh! And this is what the Rashi says. Rashi says, so when you're going through a hard time and you see like sparks of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in your life, then you realize this is just part of the journey. Hashem has not abandoned me. I'm going to tell you this happens in my own life that this happens. So a lot of you have hopefully listened to my show on Carrying the Time. You know a lot of my life stories. But those of you who are brand new, never met me or don't know, besides for lots of drama, about 6 years ago, I had a very rare autoimmune disease that almost killed me, and it was called aplastic anemia. I got it literally from 1 week to the next. They still don't know medical advancements of the day that we have, still don't know how people get aplastic anemia or don't. But it means really your bone marrow shuts down. And when your bone marrow shuts down, you have no red blood cells, you have no white blood cells, you have no platelets, and you die. Okay? But they didn't know what was wrong with me, and it's a very, very, very rare condition. At the time, I was living in London, in the UK, and they said of the 58 million people that live in the UK, only 5 people get diagnosed with aplastic anemia per year. When I found that, I told my husband, see, I told you, I'm very rare. I'm very unique. I'm like 1 in 58 million. It's quite rare. Of course, I would get the very, very rarest disease. But at the time, when I first came to hospital, they didn't know what was wrong with me, and it took them 2 weeks to diagnose me. But they did every single test, and in those 2 weeks, they said these words to me. We will try to keep you alive long enough to diagnose you. Your whole body is shutting down. We don't know what's wrong with you. It's very strange. We can't find what's wrong with you. But we're going to try and keep you alive long enough to diagnose you. And in fact, after I'd been in hospital for about a week, there was one night that I was so sick that my husband got a phone call at like 2:30 in the morning from the hospital to tell him that they think I won't make it through the night. He said he started writing my Hesper, my husband. At the time, I was so out of it. I was sleeping a lot. I didn't really understand what was going on around me, so I was really, really so sick. Anyway, so for 2 weeks they're trying to diagnose me. I had had a baby like 2 months before this had happened, so my husband was home looking after the brand new baby and all the children, plus my husband's a therapist, so he has a clinic of people, so he has this job, plus he has all these children to look after, plus he has a sick wife in hospital, and that was what he was juggling. I feel like that sounds like a normal woman's life. And here is my career, here is all my children, and here is like somebody dying that I need to look after. I feel like that's most women I know, that's like their life. But for men, I feel that's much more difficult to juggle, you know. Anyway, so he was juggling everything, so much so that actually my newborn baby, she was sleeping in his bed. Because she was sleeping in my bed before suddenly I wasn't around anymore, so she was sleeping in his bed. And so she would try and visit me. But it was very hard to visit me. I was in the hospital about half an hour drive from the house, And I was so immunocompromised, I was so sick, I was not allowed any visitors except for family. And even family had to wear masks. It was like 6 months before COVID. So we had COVID rules before COVID, and I'm always ahead of the trend. So anything happens to me, you should just know. So we were all, my family, all in masks and gloves, and they had their soap always in their house, and they had to stay like far away. Even when people visited me, they would sit on a chair over there, and I'd be in my bed here, right, because any germ could kill me. So they really had to be very, very careful. So my husband would try and visit me once a day, he'd visit me, but I would never know what time he'd visit me. Depending on babysitters, depending on clients, depending on children, depending on everything. So sometimes it'd be 9:30 in the morning, sometimes 2 o'clock in the afternoon, sometimes 9 o'clock at night. And the truth is, I wasn't on any schedule, because I was sleeping most of the time, I didn't know what was going on. But he would try and visit me once a day, and I never knew when he was going to visit me. And during that 2-week period, there were 3 times when the doctors came to tell me very bad news. 3 times. There was a head doctor and a group of about 5 junior doctors, and I was like the most mysterious client that they had, so everybody wanted to take my case. Everybody wanted to see me because everybody wanted to be the person who diagnosed me. So I had this whole group of doctors that were taking care of me, and they 3 times they diagnosed me. Only the 3rd time they got it right. The other 2 times they were telling me about horrific cancers that this all died from. Okay? And every single time, and also they didn't have a schedule. They would come whenever they could all get together and come. It wasn't like a fixed schedule. And every time they came to tell me bad news, my husband always sitting next to me. Just so happened that he was sitting next to me. And I went through, it was a very hard period in our life. I was sick in total for about 6 months. Baruch Hashem, a nace happened to me, and I'm alive and well, as you can see. But at the time, they didn't project that I would even live at all. And I always think to myself that I had to go through that very hard time. But those were my sweet smelling spices. That means I had to go through that. I had to be in the hospital. I had to get this illness. I had to go through it. This was Hashem giving me lots of, hopefully, kakaras and messages, or whatever it is that I had to go through. But any time I heard bad news, I was not alone. And that made a huge difference. And I always thought afterwards, I thought about it, I thought, those are my sweet smelling spices. Not that my life was wonderful, magical, that butterflies and rainbows, but rather, whenever something was complicated in my life, I had somebody with me. And this is really what we are trying to celebrate on Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a magical time of year because we not only speak about the miracles that happened in that time, but we speak about He'oras Panim, and we speak about Hashgacha Pratis, and we speak about exactly opposite of what the Greeks said. The Greeks said, Hashem is not involved in your life. And in fact, we talk about it in Hanukkah. We say, Rom al kol goyim Hashem an Hashemayim kovodoy. Above all the nations is Hashem. His honor sits in the heavens. Mi Hashem Elokeinu, who is like our God, Hamavdil Hashoresh, who sits on high, but who comes down from the heaven and comes down to us. We speak about it in Hallel. We say, everybody says that Hashem is on high, but really our God, he comes down to us. And the way we know that is because through Hashgacha Pratis, through the little Neshika of Hashem, that we experience in our own lives all the time. Not that we're not going off a story that happened thousands of years ago. I'm talking about right now. Right now we experience the big miracles, right? Like that year ago where half the Jewish world could have been annihilated in a night and nothing happened. And then we experience the small He'aras Panim in our own lives that we recognize as a gift from Hashem, that Hashem does not have to promise, that Hashem does not promise that to us. Hashem just gives to us as an act of love from our Kodesh Baruch Hu. But do you know what we say? We say the Shechazena Aneinu. Every day we say the Shechazena Aneinu, and Hashem should open up our eyes, the Bishul called the Tzion Barachamim, yeah? To be able to see the return to Zion, yeah? But really what we're asking Hashem, so I've got a question for you. Eyes always see. What does it mean the Shechazena Aneinu and our eyes should see? We should, our eyes do see. That's in fact the entire function of my eyes. But being able to see and being able to see miracles are totally different things. You know, sometimes you're looking for your keys and you know it's on the table but you can't see it. Has that ever happened to you? Just me? I was just like, where are the keys? I had the keys in my hand a minute ago. I put them down somewhere. I can't find the keys. Hashem, please help me find my keys. Open my eyes to see them. I know they're right in front of my face. And we ask Hashem not only to make miracles in our eyes, in our lives, but give us the eyes to see the miracles that are in our life. We could have our Shlocha process happening right in front of us, and we won't be able to see it because of why we're in Golus. We're in darkness. That's why we can't see it. And in fact, there's something so special about the menorah light that I want to share with you. So we are told that there are 6 days of creation. The first day Hashem created Orav HaChayshech, which is light and dark, and the fourth day Hashem created the sun, the moon, and the stars. What lights do we exist from in this world? The sun and the moon and the stars. So what about the light from the first day? And everybody knows that this light is called the Or Hagonos, the hidden light, because it's really a spiritual light. So in fact, the light of truth, the light of charity. But we are told there are two places where this light exists in this world. This is a hidden light that we say that is set aside for tzaddikim. But in this world, there are two places that we're going to be seeing this light. The first place is in Torah. When we learn Torah, this will light up our eyes. This will help our eyes see the truth, see the MS. And in the flame of our menorahs that we light in our own homes. In those flames, that is the Or HaGonos, the menorahs that we light in our own houses today, not only the menorah that was lit in the Beis HaMikdash. So we are told that we should try and sit by the menorah and look at the flames. I'm sure you've all heard of this, yeah? Does anyone ever try to do that in the chaos of the... Does anybody else feel like, you know, the 8 nights of Hanukkah is 8 nights of total chaos, pandemic, just my house, you know, when everybody likes the menorah and then there's donuts and then there's cookies and then there's games and there's chocolate coins and there's presents and there's family and also dinner has to be served at some point, so who wants to eat dinner after 3 donuts, nobody, but then 3 hours later everybody's hungry, everybody's fighting and there's games we want to play, right? So I tried to do this for a few years to like sit by the lights, because I want to sit by the lights. Then I started my own menorah. This is my own minhag. You're all welcome to take on my minhag. Okay? This is my minhag. I then realized that the menorahs that we light with oil. And they often stay lit till like midnight. Right? So I decided, you know what? First I'm going to feed the kids and feed everybody supper. And then we're going to play all the games. And we're going to sing the songs and the Simji chaos. And then I'm going to clear up all the wrapping paper from all the presents. And then I'm going to put all the little kids to bed. And about 10 o'clock at night, when all the kids are, there's the small kids are in bed and all the big kids, they're never going to bed, so I should just ignore them entirely. I go and sit by my menorah. And I go and I look at the flames of the menorah. And I look at them for a long time and I daven. This is the moment that I daven to Hashem. That my eyes should be able to see. The Sechazen or Einenu, that Hashem should open my eyes to see. Because everything is right in front of me. I just live in Golis, so I can't see it. But really, Yad Hashem is right in front of me, and I daven to Hashem, please help me be able to see the difference between MS and Sheker. Please, Hashem, help me be able to see what you want me to do in the world. Don't let me be so confused. Help me to be able to see it, please, Hashem. And I sit there every single night, and I want to tell you something about women. It is so important for women to do this, and I'll tell you why. Often, we forget to feed the woman that's behind the mother, the woman that's behind the wife, the woman, just the woman that you are, needs to be fed spiritual charity, needs to be fed this, and we don't sit and learn Torah. Most women don't sit in a Beis HaMikdash every single day and learn Torah. Most men hopefully have a tzvias every day for learning Torah, so they get a bit of this charity from the Torah that they learn, but most women don't do this. And nowadays, because of training time and audio shiurim, I get to listen to shiurim in the car and shiurim in my kitchen and Baruch Hashem, while I'm doing all my things, I get to listen to shiurim. But when I sit by my menorah and I look at the flames of my menorah and I govern for this charity, I am nourishing the woman that is behind the mother, the woman that is behind the wife, that woman. And that, by the way, is the ultimate self-care. But when we talk about self-care, we often talk about like getting my nails done, which you can do. I get my nails done and a massage. You should get your massage, whatever you need to. But really the self-care that you need is the spiritual nourishment that we don't get. And the lack of spiritual nourishment actually affects every single member of your household. It affects you and affects everyone. Because you know when people talk about, certain influencers, are you an influencer, blah, 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 all this nonsense. The woman is the biggest influencer in her home. You are, or every single person in this room is an influencer. You, if you are able to be inspired by the light of your menorah, you inspire all your family, your husband, your children, your cousins, your grandparents, your parents, everybody around you. You radiate this light, right? And that's why it's so important. I want to share with you something that happens in life is parasha that's so important for us to understand as an idea or as a concept, so important. So in the last parasha, we know that Yaakov and Esav meet for the first time after what happened. Everybody knows Yaakov stole the bracha from Esav, and Esav vowed to kill him. And Yaakov ran for his life, went to Laban's house, worked for him for 30 odd years, and is now coming back with his wife and children. And he knows Esav's coming to meet him. And he wants to appease Esav, because he knows Esav's really very, very angry. So he decides to do two things. He says to Esav, "Im Lavan Garfi, I lived with Lavan," and he sends Esav presents of animals. Why would these two things appease Esav? Esav sounds like a wild animal. These two things do not sound like very appeasing. Okay, so let's talk about what we know about Esav. Esav is really the symbol of the Yetzer Hara for all of us. And Esav was all about the now. I want everything right now. I want all my pleasure right now. I want to be the wealthiest. I want to be the richest. I want to have everything right now. That's why he was so angry that Yaakov got the bracha, because Yaakov was promised this beautiful land, so only milk and honey, and that they'd be right, king of the world, and all this possessions, everything. Esav was so jealous, and Esav wanted this. What do we know about Esav? Esav walks into the house very hungry, and Yaakov is making lentil soup. And Esav says, "Can I have a bowl of soup?" And Yaakov says, "If you give me your bechora, I'll give you a bowl of soup." And he says, "What do I need this bechora for? I need holech lomos. I'm anyway going to die. Why? Because what did it mean to be the bechora? To be the bechora meant that his children's children will one day serve in the Beit HaMikdash. That's what it meant. And you know what that meant to him? Nothing. It meant nothing to him. What do I care about? My children's children. Well, who cares? Doesn't benefit me at all. You have this bechora, that means nothing to me. I'll have a bowl of soup." So he sold the inheritance of his children's children for a bowl of soup. That's how much he just wanted pleasure in the now. I want my needs fulfilled right now in this world. And whatever is in the future, I couldn't care less about it. Because it's not happening to me, it's not affecting me. So Yaakov understood that this was the way Esav thought. And Yaakov knew that he got all these amazing brachas from Yitzhak. So what does he say to Esav, says he then? He says, "You think I got all this wealth and all this land and all this everything I want to know? I've lived for the last 30 years as a refugee in Lavan's house. As his, basically his servant for the last 30 years. And do you know what I have in my possessions? There are mountains of gold and silver. I have a few animals. I have sheep. Some goats." So basically, you don't have to be jealous of me, because you know what? The brachas that our father gave us is not for me. It's for my children. You don't care about that. You want this bracha? This bracha means nothing to you, because it's about your children. You were willing to sell your children's service in the Beit HaMikdash for a bowl of soup. You don't care about your generations of the generations, you only care about right now. Why? Because that is the Greek ideology. The Greek ideology is only now. There is no future, there is no nothing, there's only now, right? But we Jewish people, we know that it's all about the long game. It's all about eternity. In fact, I was listening to a podcast, a Jewish man interviewing a very wealthy non-Jewish man, an African-American man. And he starts the podcast by saying, "The first thing that I learned about wealth from a Jewish man. The way I learned all about stocks and shares and everything was a wealthy Jewish man. He hired me and I worked under him and I learned from him. And this is the first lesson I learned from him, which is why I know that why all Jews are rich." And I was like, that's why I wanted to call in to say, actually, it's not true. They're not all rich. But also, I was expecting like a really anti-Semitic result or comment or something. And then he says something that was so true. And it ties in exactly with this. He said, "The Jewish man that I worked for, he was obsessed with generational wealth. As soon as he got money, he's like, and this for my children, and this for my grandchildren, and this is going to be for my great-grandchildren. I'm going to build this school, I'm going to build this synagogue, I'm going to build this." He started saying, he was building all these things with all this money, and said, "You know what African-American people do when they get rich? First of all, they buy the 10 of the most expensive cars they can find. Then they buy themselves like 3 castles. They wear all the diamonds around their neck. And within like 3-4 years, they've blown through millions and millions and millions of dollars for nothing. Nothing, you know, nothing. They end up being homeless on the streets, right? And he said, I wish the African American community would learn from the Jewish people that generational wealth, that's how you build more and more and more wealth, like passing it on to future. Why do Jewish people think like that? Because they understand it is all about the future. It is all about belonging. It's nothing about it. Well, who cares if I sit in the palace right now? That's going to help anyone? No. I know so many wealthy people who live in like very regular houses and drive the same car that I drive, you know, and they're just building the community. They're using their money for their children's children about things they're never going to see. You know, you go to a wealthy family and you go, I know how to make sure that everybody's grandchildren won't assimilate. They're waiting to hear the idea. They want to give you money to do this. Why? They should care about other people's grandchildren, that they remain Jewish or they remain from? The answer is yes. The answer is yes, because Yaakov always represents the Yetzer HaTov, and Esau represents the Yetzer HaTov. By the way, if ever you feel you need to do something urgently, it's always the Yetzer HaTov. I must tell you this juicy piece of the Russian house right now. I must tell you off right now when I'm very angry about what you did. You deserve to know what you did. Anytime something very urgent, take a step back and ask yourself, is this my HR? Because my HR always feels very, very, very urgent. My HR service, it's always about the long game. Like, what I do now, how will that affect my me in a few years' time? What kind of person do I plan to be? What's my spiritual goals? If what I do now will affect that, then I don't want to do now. I will practice self-control. And in fact, we all understand that all our physical things are so temporary. And that the spiritual thing is eternal. So I have to share with you a story that I've shared in many of my shirms. So if some of you have heard it before, you can hear it again. Hagar is always good. And then I've got even a caveat of the story, which is such a good caveat. So there's a story of this Rebbetzin. And there's a knock on her door, and she opens the door, and it's a female mashallah. So you know, it's often men that are asking for money. Very rarely there's women, but there's sometimes women. So she opens the door, there's this female mashallah, and she says, I'm raising money for my family. You have no money. Can you please give me some money? So this Rebbetzin gives her money. And then she goes, you know, I have no clothes. Do you have any clothes that you don't wear anymore that you could give me? All women have clothes in their cupboard that they don't wear. Why am I the only one? I keep giving away clothes, but I always have clothes, but I don't wear that. Hang around. I'm like, hang on, when I'm thin again, I will wear this. Okay. But so we're all hanging on, right? So yeah, sure. She went upstairs to her bedroom. She empties out the clothes that she doesn't wear anymore. She gives it to the baby. And then the baby looks at her and goes, I really like the dress you're wearing. Can I have the dress you're wearing? Now, you and I would probably at this point slam the door in this woman's face and say, what a chutzpah! This woman wanted the shirt off my back. What is coming? I'm even angry I gave her money to begin with. What is the generation coming to? And we would repeat the story to every single person. You know what happened to me? I gave money to this poor woman and she wanted literally the shirt off my back. I can't believe I was even nice to her. What's that? I bet she's got mental health issues. Okay, that's what we would say. This Rebbetzin thought to herself, you know, the dress I'm wearing, I really like it. But within a year or two, it's going to get old and tired, maybe a bit bobbly. Maybe I won't fit into it anymore. Maybe somebody will leave it in the dryer and it'll shrink. Maybe it won't be in fashion anymore. Within a year or two, I'll either give it away or throw it in the garbage. But if I give this dress to this lady, I will have it forever. This physical dress that I bought in Zara for $80 will become eternal for me. This will turn into a mitzvah. This will no longer be just the dress that I wore that I then threw away a year or two later. This will be with me forever. So she goes, wait 1 minute. She went up to her room, she took off her dress, put on a different outfit, she put her dress in a bag and gave it to her. And this is one of the best stories to describe how something physical can be changed into something spiritual in a heartbeat, and that you can grab eternity in this world. That's what they say, like, every mitzvah is an opportunity. You can grab eternity from anything, anything, right? Okay, so I told this story a few times. One of my favorite stories to tell is about it. I had a voice note from somebody 2 days ago. I really, when I listened to it, I cried. She is one of my students. So I run chaboras like this in South Florida, 4 or 5, and then I run 2 over Zoom, one on a Monday evening and one on a Tuesday morning for women in usually the tri-state area to join my Zoom chaboras because obviously I don't live here. Okay, this woman joins my Monday night Zoom chabora already for like 6 months, and she said to me, you know the story about the dress and the mashallah? She said, this happened to me, I want to tell you what happened to me. A female mashallah came to my door. She said to me, and she asked me for money. So I wrote her check. And then she told me, you don't understand how desperate my situation. Do you have any more money to give me? I'm really desperate. So then she wrote her another check. And then she, this woman said to her, I came here with no luggage, but I really need a suitcase to go home. Do you by any chance have a spare suitcase to give me? And this woman said on the voice instantly, she said, you don't know this about me, Effie, but I love traveling. And I buy myself expensive suitcases. But I love traveling. It's one of my things. It's just the thing that I love traveling. And I looked at this woman, and I thought to myself, I don't want to give you one of my suitcases. These are expensive suitcases, my suitcases. And then I thought of the story that you told me about the dress. And I thought to myself, if I keep this suitcase, I have it maybe for 2 years, 3 years, the zip will break, something will happen, I won't have. But if I give her this suitcase, I have it forever. And I said to her, wait 1 minute. And I went to where I put my suitcase, and I picked it, and I passed her, and I gave it to her. Listen to this. Because we are not a self. It's not about, this is my expensive suitcase, and I want it, and it's mine, and I get pleasure from walking through the airport with this, and it's mine, and it's all about my own pleasure. No, we are Yaakov. In this story, in every story, we are Yaakov. We understand, it's not about the short game. It's not about how do I feel now when I'm walking through the airport with my suitcase. No, it's about the long game. It's about what's going to be waiting for you to go to me, and Olam Haba, there'll be a beautiful suitcase waiting for me, right? Mamash, that's exactly what it's like. That's the understanding. The understanding is if we really understood that we are playing the longest game, and that is Nitzchias, right? And that's what the Chashem Aram understood. Chashem Aram understood that the Greeks were all about this moment, this beautiful painting, this wonderful architecture, this beautiful poem, and they are all beautiful. True. But it's just this minute. It goes in a second. It's not, it's so temporary, it's almost laughable. In fact, there isn't even this moment. I was once reading like a very complicated philosophical, like, there's no such thing as present. It's always past or future. There isn't such thing as this moment. And I'm like, this is so confusing. I can't live like this. This is such a confusing obstacle. They're trying to prove that, like, there's no such thing as this moment. But I understood what they were saying. Sometimes we think that this moment is so important, it's more important than what I want for me to do. It's more important, like, the thing that I want right now that I think will feed my material or my physical, or my, it's so, so important that everything else is, you know, is, what do I care about? Do I even understand what Olam Haba is? And then our neshama, our pintalias, comes up, because we're all descendants of Yaakov Avinu. And we know that's all about the long game, and then that's the most important thing. So we are all trying to look at our mitzvahs and trying to fall in love with our mitzvahs because we all live, everybody in this room, we live very committed lives. But do we live inspired lives? We might as well live inspired lives if we're going to be committed anyway. If we're going to do it, if you're going to keep Shabbos anyway, you might as well love it, right? You might as well feel inspired by it. It should light up your neshama. Anything that you're doing it already, right? So then we should connect ourselves to it, because when we connect ourselves to this, these mitzvahs, then it becomes something infinite. You know, that we say the Hashlocha process gives us a different perspective of life, and this is the meaning of the number 8. 8 is always Lamara Min HaTeva, right? And that's why the Kohen Gadol, the menorah lasts 8 days, and the Kohen Gadol lights it while wearing his Shmoneh Begadim, his 8 garments of clothing, and because what it's trying to teach us is that everything is out of this world. Everything. And by the way, when we pick ourselves up and we elevate ourselves to make sure that we do things that are really above nature, that means we behave against, we're not reactive. Instead, we pause and we think, what does Hashem want for me to do in this moment? What does Hashem want for me to do in this moment? Then we elevate ourselves to the highest level, and then we take ourselves to a totally different level, and this is the amazing thing about Christ. So I want to finish off with this beautiful story, because I feel like this is something that we are all trying to achieve, and we want to be. So there's a story about Yeshiva Bacha. So actually, I've got 2 Yeshiva Bacha in Lakewood, and I was visiting them on Sunday. Whenever I do a tri-state student, so I always make sure there's a day in Lakewood, so I can take them to Glut Bites. Have you heard of Glut Bites? Apparently their coppers are out of this world. Okay. So there we go. And whenever I go to Lakewood, I'm always so overwhelmed by how beautiful the buildings are, especially the yeshivas. They're like castles. Have you seen them? Okay. Where I come from in London, the yeshivas are all like the oldest houses with the oldest benches and the oldest chairs, like the Mesirat Nefesh. And then I come to Lakewood and like marble floors. There's something about it feels a bit, but I'm not making any justice. Anyway, so we're now talking about a yeshiva bacha that lived 100 years ago in the shtetl in Europe. If you were a yeshiva bacha in the shtetl in Europe 100 years ago, this is what it meant. You lived hundreds of miles away from your family. You often didn't see your family for many years, maybe never again. You were sent at your bar mitzvah, and you would live in a tiny ramshackle house, and you would sleep on the wood floors, and you would eat 3 meals a day, but they weren't luxurious 3 meals a day, okay? And it's very much Mesirat Nefesh, so it's like 10 yeshiva bachurim per yeshiva, not 500, okay? And they would never really be Mesirat Nefesh, okay? So there's a yeshiva bachur. He's about 18 years old. He's been there since he's 13. He learns morning, afternoon, and evening a real Talmud Chacham, real Mesirat Nefesh. Mesirat Nefesh, like you and I, have never seen, experienced, or can ever understand, okay? And he goes up to the Rosh Hashiva and he says, you know, recently I've been finding it increasingly hard to have to see so much Nefesh for Torah learning. It's very hard. It's very hard to live so far away from family. It's very hard to be learning all day and all night. And what I feel I need, I really need to meet Eliyahu HaNavi. You know, we talk about stories about Eliyahu HaNavi coming to learn Torah with people in this world. And I feel if I would meet Eliyahu HaNavi, I'd be able to be most of Nefesh for Torah learning for the rest of my life. I just want to feel spiritually connected. Now, all of us can understand that feeling. We've all felt times in our life where we want to be spiritually connected and we want to feel the Te'aras Ponim and feel Hashem in our lives and see a little bit the future so that we can feel connected, right? And this boy was being very sincere. It was no shtick, just very sincere. So Rosh Hashiva listened to him and he said, thought about it for a little while and said, I have a way for you to meet Eliyahu HaNavi. Okay? He said, in this village, at the end of the village, lives an Amona, a widow. Her husband died last year. She lives in this house with 3 young children, and they're very poor, and they have nothing. And really, we need to take care of them. So if on Friday, what you do is you go to a few of the wealthy people in town, and you say, I'm collecting money for the Amona, and you collect money, and then you go to the market. You buy them some food. Buy them fruits and vegetables. Buy them bread and chicken and milk. Buy them some groceries. And then you walk to their house. Their house is right at the end of the village. It's like a 20-minute walk all the way to the end. And you deliver to them food for Shabbos, your meat, and your Navi. Sounds like a good deal. Would you do that? I would do that. I would do that for me and your Navi, sure. So he said, fine. So Friday he goes to a few of the wealthy people in the neighborhood and collecting money for Amona. He goes to the marketplace, he picks fruits and vegetables, he picks different food for them, he carries his bag and he walks all the way to the end of the village, to the last house. And as he gets closer, he sees this house, he can't believe anybody lives in this house. The most ramshackle house, it looks like everything's falling down, and he can't believe anyone even lives there. He knocks on the door, and this woman opens the door, and she has 3 little kids hanging onto her skirt. And he says, I've come to bring you food for Shabbos. And he gives her the bag. And she's like, who are you? He says, I'm nobody. I just come to bring you food for Shabbos. And one of the little kids looks inside the bag, pulls out the loaf of bread, tears it in half, and starts eating it immediately because they were starving. 100 years ago, your husband dies. You're alone. You could starve to death. Not a joke. Yeah? Okay. And then he leaves. And as he walks back to the yeshiva, he's waiting to meet Eliyahu HaNavi. This is so exciting. So all the way back to yeshiva, he does not meet Eliyahu HaNavi. He goes to Rosh Hashiva and he says, I didn't meet Eliyahu HaNavi. So Rosh Hashiva says, no, you have to do this many times. If you do this every Friday, then I promise you, I guarantee you, you'll meet Eliyahu HaNavi. So he starts doing it every Friday. He leaves yeshiva at lunchtime. He goes to collect some money. Already people know who he is. He collects money for how he goes to buy food. Every time, different types of food, whatever he can find in the marketplace. Sometimes fish, sometimes chicken, whatever you find. And he carries it. He walks all the way down to Ezra Village. He knocks on the door. He opens the door. I come to bring you food for Shabbos. Who are you? Nobody just comes to bring you food for Shabbos. And he leaves. So the second week, third week, fourth week, fifth week, the sixth week, as he's walking down the road, as he gets close to the house, he's almost at the house. And he hears two of the kids speaking to each other from the window. And one says to the other one, do you think Eliyahu HaNavi will also come this week to bring us food for Shabbos? Do you you think anyone of you will also come this week to bring us food for Shabbos. And then he understood what the Rosh Hashiva was teaching him. Because it's not good enough to see the light that he was doing when he was learning Torah all day. We have to be the light. We have to be the Eliyahu HaNavi. And when we are, we bring the Shekhinah down into this world. We bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence down into this world. And if we are able to not only see the light, we are able to be the light. This is the biggest gift we can give to our children, our children's children, our children's children. We, everybody in this room, for the dreams of the people that were gassed in the Holocaust, for the dreams of the people that were killed in the pogroms 500 years ago, we are the descendants, we are their legacy, because they knew that even as they were dying, that the collective soul of Klal Yisrael would never die, because Klal Yisrael would always be the descendants of Yaakov Avinu, who's able to put the spiritual wealth high above any physical pleasure we can get in this world. And I want to wish everybody a wonderful Hanukkah.